You may be seated. Okay, we're on case 11-742, Burlingame versus the Estate of Burlingame. For the appellant.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time, please.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my
time,
please.
Okay.
My name is Kevin Lamadou. I represent the appellants in this case, the City of Canton and James Coombs. Whether going to a house fire or a crime in progress, the public relies on our first responders to arrive quickly. The General Assembly enacted 2744 in order to provide significant leeway for our first responders, our police and our firefighters, the ability to do that. They did so by immunizing them from conduct that fell short of willful, wanton, and reckless behavior. Now, the issue in this case is whether that standard can be modified either by traffic statutes or by internal policies that are most often more restrictive than the willful, wanton, and reckless standard set forth by the General Assembly. The trial court in this case went along with the 7th, 8th, 9th, and 11th districts in holding that it could not. But now, for the first time, at least as far as we're aware, the 5th District has decided that that standard can, in fact, be so modified. This is an important issue because instead of looking simply to the facts surrounding these circumstances to determine whether or not an actor perversely disregarded a known risk, they can now look to policy violations or statutory violations to first defeat summary judgment and then probably confuse a jury, all while watering down effectively the standard of willful, wanton, and reckless.
Counsel, is willful and wanton a subjective or an objective standard in your view?
I think it could be both. I think that certainly the appellees are arguing that that's a very important element. It certainly can be. I mean, when you talk about willful, wanton, or in bad faith, I think that's used for employees. It certainly can be a subjective determination. I agree with that. But I think there is also an objective component. For example, if somebody were to deny the knowledge of what a statute requires or even a policy requires, I doubt a court is going to relieve them of the responsibility to know of the conduct that is prohibited, not the statute itself, but the conduct. So, for example, if a statute prohibits you from going over a double yellow line, if for some reason somebody was able to deny its existence, they certainly couldn't deny the safety impact of, in fact, going over the double yellow line. So there's probably components in both. But that is why, in this case, we're proposing that the court adopt a bright-line rule that policies, internal policies, rules, and regulations, as well as traffic statutes, cannot be used to define the contours of willful, wanton, and reckless under Chapter 2744. There are at least three problems with the Fifth District's ruling. First of all, that it compromises public policy, that it is contrary to legislative policy, and that it results in an unwarranted and pretty unpredictable extension of the law. If the court doesn't have another order, I'd like to talk about the public policy reasons first here, because I think those have the greatest ramifications. Policies in the City of Canton, like other political subdivisions, provide a framework for administrations to conduct and evaluate job performance. Oftentimes, they are used to set a higher standard to even further protect both the first responders themselves and the public they serve. They're used to, as I said, evaluate job performance. So you could make salary determinations or promotional decisions or disciplinary decisions based upon those policies. But now, as I said, for the first time that we're aware of, that can be used to also define the contours of recklessness. Now, of course, the danger there is now cities and political subdivisions are they're in a position where now they have to choose between keeping these policies, these restrictive policies that allow them to hold their employees to a higher standard, but now invite a greater chance of liability, or abandoning them so that they can enjoy the full protection of immunity, as the General Assembly intended, but at the same time getting rid of those same policies that, as I said, have a greater chance of protecting the first responders and the motoring public. And the problem here is, as I fear, and as the federal cases that we've cited that compared federal immunity to state immunity as the Sixth Circuit said in the Freeland case, they're going to choose to abandon these policies. They would have to. They wouldn't want to. We certainly wouldn't want to. Obviously, we put them in place.
We have to go as far as your proposition of law propounded. I could see where you have in your proposition is not relevant at all. Couldn't internal policies or traffic violations be one factor as to whether there was willful or wanton or reckless behavior on the part of a public responder?
Well, as I said, I think if you count it as a factor, if it's a factor at all, and there's any chance that a city, I think, is in this case provides a very good example, if there's a chance that that policy can be used by a plaintiff to get past summary judgment and to a jury, I think it would be very confusing to the jury and also, I think, compromise the political subdivision's ability to be able to get have the case disposed in summary judgment. So if it's a factor, in this case, I think is a very good example, because looking at the facts themselves, there are no facts really that demonstrate willful, wanton, and reckless behavior. He accidentally ran a red light. Other than that, I mean, it's light outside, the pavement is dry, the traffic is light. I mean, these are all factors that courts traditionally consider in making this analysis.
So the plaintiff's only basis for liability is the violation of the internal policies and the traffic laws?
Well, I'm loath to make that representation on their behalf. I'm sure they're going to argue there's something more, so I don't want to say that. But I think if you look at the Fifth District's decision, I think the risk is what's going to happen is exactly what's going to happen here. You have facts that are very innocuous that, under the cases we cite in page 10 of our reply brief, facts that never before under any case that we've cited or seen would rise to that level. You're now going to have cases getting past summary judgment simply based upon, as it looks to me, simply based upon a rule violation, a policy violation, excuse me, and a possible statutory violation. So, Your Honor, I think that's the risk here, is that even being allowed to consider them as a factor, which the Fifth District held, I think will ultimately be confusing to a jury and make political subdivisions and their employers have to go to trial when they never have been before.
Thank you.
Counsel, would it be a fair interpretation? This case procedurally gets to decide on summary, your motion for summary judgment.
Yes, it was.
Decided favorably to the city.
Yes.
Would it be fair to say that a fair reading of how do you say a judge's name?
Frascione.
Frascione.
Yes.
Concluded that the immunity statute is absolute, that there are no set of facts that could get you past summary here, because he points out that the if a fireman is responding to a fire call, the way I read it, he says you're immune. He says the statute doesn't even say you have to have lights and sirens going. He blows off the fact that the siren wasn't working by saying there's no requirement for that.
Well, I would respectfully disagree with the fact that he blew it off. It did. The evidence was that although the siren had turned off shortly after leaving the station, that they were blowing the air horn, and it was very, very loud. And so I think what he was saying was, yes, the siren wasn't working. But he was considering all the facts and circumstances, and the siren was one, and, yes, it wasn't working. On the other hand, it's not as though there was no audible signal. There was.
Well,
it was
at the bottom of the third page of his opinion, he says, there's no language in the statute that would require the operation of a motor vehicle to involve the use of either emergency lights or siren or both.
I believe that's
so he sees this, would it be fair to say he sees this immunity as absolute, short of the fireman being drunk or
I don't
some
believe
such
he does
thing.
I'm sorry, I don't believe he thinks it is absolute. I just think what he was saying was, first of all, I'm not going to consider policy violations. Secondly, I'm not going to consider traffic law.
And factually,
we cited.
He also acknowledges, does he not, that the fireman driving this truck, although he says he's a police police department, in his opinion. This was a firefighter, was it not?
Yes.
Says that approximately seven, the Canton Police Department, specifically James Combs, captain. So he refers to him as a policeman rather than a firefighter.
If that's in there, that was a mistake. This is a firefighter.
He says that the firemen also believed that the some sort of automatic system would have turned all these lights to red for the intersecting traffic.
Yes.
That was not the case either.
The testimony from the firefighter was that he didn't – there's a preemption system. Most cities have a preemption right. system. And the firefighter was asked in the deposition, can it be triggered by the air horn as opposed to the siren? He said, I think it can. I wasn't sure. I've never had the preemption system not work. The deposition of the traffic engineer taken several months later revealed that, in fact, it could not trigger the preemption system.
Okay, so it wasn't working, and so – He's going through a red light with the fire truck. That's not in dispute.
It is not in dispute that he went through a red light, but that it's also not in dispute that he thought it was green.
It's not in dispute that he swerved when he saw this car turn and went left to center.
His testimony was that he tried to avoid the accident by braking and swerving left of center, but he could not. That's correct.
Okay. So I guess what I'm getting at is, how is that not enough to get you past summary?
Because, in our opinion, and based upon the cases that we cited, the standard is willful, wanton, and reckless. I mean, again, looking at the factors that all of these courts, and there are a lot of them.
Now, you drive around, we all do, and we see all kinds of emergency vehicles, and you're always looking for how do I get out of the way. But wouldn't it be fair to state that apparently there's been pretty careful instruction to policemen, ambulance drivers, and fire truck drivers to, when they're going through red lights, to do that with caution and care? I mean, it seems to me, I hate to make it personal, but in my observation, I see these people slow down when they come to intersections. Any kind of emergency vehicle.
And that's Canton's policy. And, in fact, when he was asked at his deposition, what would you have done if you'd seen the light be red? He said, I would have stopped in accordance with that policy. He knew what the policy was. He just thought it was green.
And I guess he would have stopped? No, he would have slowed down.
He would have, I think.
There's no requirement to stop.
Yeah. There is no requirement to stop. There is in our policy, Your Honor. In our policy, in fact, if the light is red, that's what I'm talking about. Our policy is so much more restrictive.
Right.
Our policy states that if the light is red, you have to not just stop, Your Honor. You have to actually make eye contact with the driver. So it's even more restrictive than even 45-1103 and much more restrictive than the willful, wanton, and reckless,
and
of course.
This was the policy on which Mr. Combs was trained?
Yes.
And all the captain that was ordering him to slow down and use your air horn, those are all reactions based on the training that is afforded these first responders by the city?
Yes.
And that training comports with their rules, even though they're stricter than what the statute actually requires?
Yes, that's their training, yes. And he said he was aware of it and that had he known the light was red, he would have stopped. And I guess to get back to your question, Justice Pfeiffer, I think that's the danger here is really what you have is a firefighter on his way to a house fire, the smoke they can see in the sky, accidentally ran a red light. He thought it was green, and that's really all you've got. And in that case, in these kinds of facts, if that case is going to go to a jury, then almost every case in which there's even the most slightest misstep is going to go to trial. At this point, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time, if I could.
Thank you. Ms. Burek?
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the Court. I'm Attorney Burek, representing the appellee Estate of Grace Burlingame. To address a few things that the court had just brought up, we disagree vehemently that he accidentally ran a red light. He had no siren. He continues going the speed limit, over the speed limit, actually. He mistakenly goes against his training and relies on the fact that he thinks the peremptor is going to change his light to green. Well, he's trained that he needs a siren to do that. He knows a siren isn't working. He relies on that wrong.
But he had the air horn as a substitute for the siren, and he testified that he did not know that the air horn would not trigger the preemption on the light system.
I understand, but when you talk to the person that does the training for the fire department, he says they're clearly trained on that fact. It's in the policies and procedure manuals for their training, and that they're trained that only a signal will change it.
Why is all that, that even if assuming what you have said is true, to me, that's negligence. That's not willful and wanton. How do you get to willful and wanton?
Well, I guess because he says accidentally, and that goes to negligence. Our position is you must look at the totality. That is the test.
You think he deliberately ran the light.
I don't think that wanton, reckless requires deliberately either, Your Honor. I feel that
Is that reckless indifference?
Reckless indifference says that you know your actions are probably going to result in an injury. It doesn't say you have to know what the injury is. It says your actions are probably going to result in an injury. How can that be any clearer? Your actions, you clearly know that you're running a red light. They actually testified they saw the van pulling out. They also testified that they knew an ambulance had already gone through the intersection, which would be confusing, which are all facts taken into consideration in many of the cases that we cited. And then we're saying, well, there's absolute immunity. No, there's not.
But if we accept the standard that you're postulating with the factors that you are saying are willful and wanton, we pretty much will send every case to a jury under your standard, will we not?
I disagree with that. There are facts. If you have, it depends on the facts, and that's what has to go to a jury. If my fireman had a siren and his lights operating and he slowed at the red light, does that go to a jury? No. If my fireman is driving through and he has a siren and lights operating and he's going less than the speed limit, doesn't go to a jury. That's a consideration. But to say we don't get to a jury to even get to hear our facts, and then to say, well, we're creating an exception, we're not creating an exception. The immunity statute is clear. There is an exception to immunity. They don't have absolute immunity. So we have to understand what is the purpose of that exception if we don't apply it. It has to be applied.
That raises a question that I've reviewed, and I want to make sure I understand it. There are two different standards, one to apply to an employee and one to apply to a political subdivision in the immunity section. Am I right? One is reckless and one is wanton.
I believe reckless can be for both the employee. Reckless, wanton, and willful are the three terms that come to my mind for an employee, mm-hmm. or an emergency responder.
Okay. And what is the standard then for the political subdivision?
For an employee who's responding to an emergency?
No, for the subdivision itself to.
Then I think it's a wanton standard.
Did the Court of Appeals confuse those two standards in its opinion, in your view?
Not in my opinion. I believe that they looked and said that this test is totality, and that they said, based on the totality of all the circumstances, we met our burden to get to a jury.
You don't see the two standards as different for the employee and the political subdivision. You see it as one standard.
Correct. I see it as one standard with the definition.
Even though there's a reckless component in one and it's not for the other.
I think that the reckless, wanton, and willful, even though that reckless is in one, I see it as the same in that you have a right to have your circumstances looked at and applied. And there won't be confusion because you'll use jury instructions to define.
I wonder why the legislature would have two separate standards if it all means the same thing.
I just believe that when the legislator drafted that statute, they were looking at what is required to meet the immunity so that they made sure that there was some exception. And if you want to go with the exception that if you're going to make it such a high standard, then there's total immunity. You would never get past a summary judgment if we can't bring in these types of facts and say these are so egregious that we get past summary judgment.
Thank you.
Counsel, can I ask you, absent the policies, what is your evidence that you would put on as to willful and reckless conduct? Because I think counsel for the city of Canton makes a good argument. If we rule in your favor, that would cause cities and political subdivisions not to have policies that would, in the overall, protect the public by training and constraining behavior at work.
Well, number one, I think I would have to be incensed if they did away with their policies and procedures just because they're worrying about money. I think that weighing a scale of money versus public safety is completely against my belief. To me, what we would have to present, if they say that, then we would present that we had a witness directly behind the van who said that our clients had a green light, that a siren had just proceeded through the intersection with its siren operating, which would be confusing, which is in case law. We would also present the fact that he knew his siren was not working, and he knew that he was then to become a vehicle and operate under all other traffic violations and traffic codes as any other vehicle on the road. So we would present that. We have two affidavits from experts that were presented who are trained in the fire emergency fields that said this was clearly egregious conduct. We have that he saw the van. They sit up. They're approaching an offset intersection, which he knew about. He can see the van. His companion on the truck could see the van pulling out, and he's still going. And he's still thinking somehow, miraculously, he's going to get a green light. And so he plows into the van and kills a person. So those are the facts I'm going to present, that he never slowed down. He didn't take any evasive action, and he's driving a 40,000-pound vehicle.
So you dispute whether he applied the brakes and tried to avoid the van?
We don't have any evidence in the police report or anything that he applied brakes. He testified to that. We don't have any witness that said that, and the witness behind the vehicle did not say that. So in our estimation, that's something that's a self-serving statement that would get us past summary judgment.
When you said he testified to that, who's the he?
Officer Combs said at some point that he thought he applied his brakes.
Right.
And swerved.
And did he also testify that he thought he had a green light?
In the beginning, Your Honor, at the trial court level, he testified that he believed his light was green. It was not till we got to the appellate court level that the city made a statement to the Court of Appeals that they changed their opinion, and now they were saying that he had the red light. And that was after we had already filed our affidavits from the independent witness saying clearly he had a red light.
Okay.
I reserve some time for Attorney Reed, unless you have any other questions for me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Reed.
Madam Chief Justice, Your Honors, my name is Orville Reed, and I represent the estate of Mr. Burlingame, who was fatally injured in this accident, who was killed at the scene of the accident. I, along with Mr. Lombardi, represent his estate. A couple of things. Justice Sweeney, raised the question. There is a dichotomy.
That would be Justice O'Donnell.
It's all right.
O'Donnell, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
All the Irish look alike.
Know,
go ahead,
I know that.
I know who you're talking to.
Right, the prejudice came out. I'm sorry, Your Honor. Your Honor, you raised the question about the dichotomy in the language between the qualified immunity that applies to the entity vis-a-vis the immunity afforded to the employee under 2744.03A6. And, Your Honor, I think to that point, this court will recall its decision in Thompson versus McNeil at 53 Ohio State 3rd. And in that case, Your Honor, this court specifically stated that the terms recklessness, wanton, and willful are often used interchangeably. Those three concepts, I think, have been treated by this court historically interchangeably. I think the Thompson case is instructive. As a matter of fact, I think the Thompson case is dispositive of the two very abstract issues that have been presented by the appellant in this case. What role does the violation of a statute play? What role does the violation of an internal policy play in terms of assessing whether or not an actor has engaged in wanton or willful or reckless misconduct? And the distinction this court made in Thompson and that has been applied in O'Toole and that was applied in Fabry is this. is there a disposition to perversity? And the issue is this. In the violation of a statute, in the violation of an obligation, is there a substantial likelihood of injury? That is the disposition to perversity. If this actor violates a statute and knows, or it appears from an objective standard, Your Honor, that this is, in all probability, will produce an injury, so that it can be distinguished from the concept of negligence, where there's a risk of injury. If there is a probability of a substantial injury, that is a disposition to perversity. That is the definition that this court has applied since Thompson.
So you are looking at the consequences, but you are not looking at the cause of the behavior, whether the behavior was willful or wanton. You're not looking at their cause.
Your Honor, I think, Your Honor, that's the way this court has applied the that's the way this court has typically and traditionally applied the concept of disposition toward perversity. If one objectively looks at this, is there a substantial likelihood that injury is going to occur? Your Honor, I think you asked the question, do you believe...
But I don't think, you know, looking at the facts, you've got a firefighter responding to a fire, you've got a air horn. I mean, the facts you tell me in this scenario don't, you know, I think it doesn't lead to that certainty that an injury is going to happen. It's not any different than if this person was negligent. I don't see the difference in this fact pattern.
Your Honor, here's where I think the distinction is. Clearly, in many cases, simply going through a red light is negligence. And it happens every day. We all know that. But in this case, Your Honor, we know that this gentleman did go through a red light. Did he go through a red light deliberately? I think he did. Reasonable minds might disagree, and that is why we have what plaintiff counsel calls the very confusing process of allowing juries to decide these cases. But nevertheless, Your Honor, I think he did deliberately go through it, like most people deliberately go through red lights. However, in many cases, there is no substantial likelihood of injury. It's a risk. Sometimes it's an unreasonable risk. Sometimes it's an unreasonable risk that does not result in any damage whatsoever, and people get away with it. But the fact of the matter is, Your Honor, in this case, this gentleman not only went through a red light, he not only went into the intersection, he increased his speed. He did not go in with the trepidation of someone who's thinking, I have the right to be here. He didn't have the right to be there. He had no right to go through that red light. And, Your Honor, the fact of the matter is, these people were in a position to see traffic stopped, waiting for their right to enter the intersection. There was a substantial likelihood that because they were at his right, they were going to either go straight through and right into his path, they were going to go straight ahead, right into his path, or
counsel,
they were going to make a left-hand turn and proceed on Cleveland Avenue,
counsel,
right into his path.
Counsel, what's Mr. Burlingame's responsibility here, the decedent? I mean, there's air horns going off and lights. There was the first emergency vehicle that goes through the intersection, presumably when it was green. And then Mr. Coombs is still testifying that the air horn is going off. I believe that there was independent testimony that everybody heard the air horn. Where's the decedent's responsibility?
Well, Your Honor, a couple things. One is I don't know what the air horn meant to Mr. Burlingame. I don't know what that meant to him. And, Your Honor, historically in this society, we know what a siren is. We know absolutely what a siren means, and that is the approach of an emergency vehicle. And that generally means be cautious, be careful. Someone is in need of help, and someone is rushing to their aid. In this case, we have an air horn. Now, that's a distinction, perhaps, that at my advanced age, I'm the only one permitted to make that. But I think it's a distinction that's valid when we weigh Mr. Burlingame's conduct. Your Honor, I would also say this.
Do you think that the alternative use of an air horn as opposed to a siren is so unknown to the public about what that possibly could mean that that Mr. Coombs driving should be aware that, heck, the public doesn't know what an air horn means?
No, Your Honor, I don't say that. I don't say that. You asked me how it affects Mr. Burlingame's conduct.
What you said prompted my question about whether it's reasonable to even assume that the public wouldn't know what an air horn meant on a rescue vehicle.
Well, Your Honor, then I would ask you why they have sirens and why that is an alternative. But the fact of the matter is...
Are the lights operating? I know there was testimony that the siren went out.
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't recall anything about the lights.
Your Honor, there's no evidence that the light was light was not working. There's no evidence of that. So I think we can assume safely for purposes of this argument that it was. Your Honor, the problem here is this. I think that... In spite of the fact that he had the air horn going, Your Honor, the fact of the matter is the light was red. He knew it was red. And I know he says that he thought it was green, but the fact of the matter is that light was red. And the policy says you can't go through the red light. And, Your Honor, the policy also reads that if some part of the safety mechanism is not working, then you have to treat it as a non-emergency run. Those are factors that weigh into this. And whether or not, in light of the circumstances of cars poised to come into that intersection, and the fact that he increases his speed as he goes through the intersection, I think those are all factors that weigh in terms of the fact that there is evidence from which this court can conclude that case should go to a jury.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Counsel, you've saved under a minute.
Briefly, the three facts that were brought up, they were not disputed. I want to make sure that the court is clear. The fact that Firefighter Coombs applied the brakes and steered to try to avoid hitting the van, those facts are undisputed. There was no other evidence indicating that.
So he didn't accelerate going through the intersection?
He did not, Your Honor. In fact, his testimony, if you look at his testimony, was that he was at 35 to 40 before he started to slow down. And if you look at his testimony carefully, he says that he went to put his foot back from the accelerator to the brake, never did it, and that's when he saw the van. That's his testimony. There's no indication that he accelerated. There's no testimony, moreover, that regardless of what happened, he was ever going more than 40 miles an hour, more than 5 miles an hour with the speed limit. That was the fastest he was ever going, according to the testimony. And finally, the color of the light. There's no dispute. He always believed the color of the light was green. I mean, there's no dispute about that. We later conceded that the light was red based upon the traffic engineer's testimony. We conceded that point for the purposes of summary judgment, knowing that we had to. At that point, we simply decided to put forth cases that demonstrated under this factual scenario, weighed against that continuum, that clearly this fact scenario weighed in favor of summary judgment. And
the trial court talked about malice and bad faith in its opinion, and we didn't discuss that in terms of the standard. Is that part of the statutory standard on the immunity, or is that through case law?
That's what Justice O'Donnell asked that question, whether the standard was different, and they are slightly different. For political subdivisions, it's willful and wanton, and for individuals under 2744A6B, it's malicious purpose, bad faith, wanton, and reckless. I think you're considering a case tomorrow that decides whether or not those two standards are different. We didn't in this case. We didn't feel it was necessary. There are cases out there that suggest, as Mr. Reed told you, that they're substantially similar. And for our purposes, there were. We didn't feel the need to try to distinguish them and parse that out, simply based upon the facts here that we thought were, at the time, very clearly suggesting that summary judgment was appropriate.
So
yes,
in your
statutory standard, Your Honor.
In your approach to this was it was purely negligence, so we don't need to get to malicious, willful, wanton. The facts are indisputable that it is pure negligence on your client's behalf.
That's correct. We simply looked at recklessness because of malice, bad faith, and all the other standards. We figured, well, recklessness is the lowest. Let's not confuse things by talking about malice and bad faith. And there's absolutely no indication of malice or bad faith, of course. This is simply a firefighter who accidentally went through a green light. That's all it was. And that's why we just simply went after recklessness. We figured it would make it easier.
If you conceded if you didn't have statements to the contrary that I thought it was green, if he admitted I knew it was red, would you be in a different position here?
We would definitely. Well, it's certainly a different position. However, if you, again, if you look at the cases we cited in our brief, there are cases out there. There are several of them, in fact, where safety personnel knowingly go through red lights or stop signs.
Sure.
So would we be in a different position? We'd be in a tougher position. Would we be in an impossible position? Not based upon the case law that we've seen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision. Thank you very much.